The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Hyundai, Ireland's fastest growing car brand. Join the Hyundai revolution. The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Hyundai. Everyone's talking about the revolution driven by Hyundai, Ireland's fastest growing car brand.
Welcome back to the programme. Marion, what a great song, The Streets of New York. My dad, Paddy, and his brother, Brian O'Reilly, must have sung that five times on St. Patrick's Day in the Gresham in Dublin, much to the delight of visiting Americans. There you go. Somebody else rings in and says, very confidently, Lent finishes at 12 midday on Easter Saturday. So that means in another 21 minutes you could open up your first Easter egg, I presume, if you're so inclined. Now, I'm sitting...
Have your first drink.
Pardon?
Or have your first drink.
Or have your first drink. The voice being of the newly returned Charlie Bird, who spent the month of February in extraordinary circumstances, over 1,000 miles, kilometres, I should say, north of the Arctic Circle. And we spoke to you while you were there, Charlie, and now you're back. I'm looking back on the whole experience. What stands out for you?
Well, it's simple. Just to spend a month with a tiny community, a small group of people. I thought it was about 135 people there. In fact, when I got there, it was only 125. You might say, well, that's not all that much, but it's, you know, 10 less people than I had in my head. You know, the size of Grease Fjord, you could put it into the campus of RTE. You know, even the size of the RTE canteen, if you put everybody in there, this whole little community of people, what I call perched on top of the world, it's just fantastic. And they were coming out of their dark period. Sometimes, you know, we don't think of these things, you know, that it's where the Arctic is, the Arctic Circle, we have notions of it. But these people live in extraordinary circumstances and they've been living there basically for thousands of years. So just to go in there, spend a month in that community was just one of those things I've always wanted to do, something like that.
Right. I mean, one of the things I see is that they have a horrendous suicide rate, which strikes me as not surprising. If they live in 24-hour darkness for half the year, that would drive everybody around the bend.
Yes, the suicide rate among the Inuit in the whole of Nunavut, now there's only 30,000 Inuit people living up in this part of Canada. There's only 150,000 Inuit in the world.
Right.
In fact, when I was growing up as a kid, we knew them as Eskimos.
Eskimos, yeah.
Simple, Eskimos. Yeah. And there were great on television images of them, you know, ice holes, taking out fish. But they're Inuit. And yes, they live in this difficult situation. And in Nunavut, there's 30,000 people. The suicide rate, unfortunately, is 10 times that of the rest of Canada. Now, that it's just absolutely extraordinary that in the space of this 40 or 50 years that the suicide rate has just shot up.
And you enormous. Don't think it's because of the light?
Well, it may be to some extent, but if you think about it, these people 60 years ago were semi-nomadic people. They lived in tiny communities and they weren't in settlements. In the past 60 years, they have moved into settlements. And since then, they have, if you like, what we would call, if you like, Western problems, Western diseases, alcoholism, suicide, unfortunately. And then the medical problems. They now suffer from diabetes, heart disease, high blood pressure, because they're now eating Western food. They are now eating
what they
call...
And where do they get it from?
Well, they go to the shop. They eat shop food now, where 60 years ago they weren't eating all that much shop food.
But I can't see delivery vans coming up to the shop.
No, because food to get to Grease Fjord takes about 14 days. And the amount of fresh food that is up there is absolutely... it's not all that much. It would take 14 days to get from Quebec, from Montreal, to get up there. That's how long. So if the people in the co-op store want to order food, fresh food, it takes about 14 days. There's no such thing as fresh milk up there. They have this long life milk. They never see a bottle of fresh milk. It's just not on their on the horizon. If they want to,
they're hunters.
They are still hunter-gatherers. Yeah, that is the one thing that absolutely took me aback. Now, I was there, Marion, was it 7 or 8 years ago, and it was in May time, and I was out on what they call out on the land, out with a dog sled team and an Inuit hunter, Japity was his name, and I told the story once before, but I think it's still worth telling, that we were filming for the documentary for RTE, and we came across an Inuit family. Young kids, and they were covered in blood. Their hands were all covered in blood and their faces were covered in blood. And I was sort of taken aback. I was sort of horrified looking at them. And they'd been eating a baby seal and they'd been eating the baby seal raw. And the Inuit hunter looked at me, JPD looked at me, and he said to me, why are you taken aback at this? And I said, well, just the image of it. And he said, but in Ireland, do you not eat spring lamb? And I said, yes, I said, I love spring lamb. Well, he said, this is the same for us. This is where we live in the globe. This is where we live in the world. And up here, in fact, Marion, there isn't a blade of grass for 2,000 miles
right.
or a tree. So the food that they get, they eat most of their food raw. They're now eating shop food, but they still mix it in with what they call country food. And the main majority of the Inuit people still eat their country food raw.
And so that would consist of?
Well, they eat the caribou, an animal called muskox, which is like a small bison, which lives up in the Arctic. And they eat seal, is one of the big thing that they eat. And they also use the seal. And I think in the videos which I shot for the Irish Times, we came across one of the hunters, Larry, who was one of the original settlers in Grease Fjord. And he was just out every couple of days getting seal, getting them from netting them, or at this time of the year they will start to shoot them. But they need them to feed their dogs, and they use their dogs so they can go out hunting. And it's one of those. It's the cycle
of
life.
It's all connected.
So
yeah.
They are still. They are still hunter gatherers.
And they eat polar bear.
Yes, they do eat polar bear. And it's sort of, initially you might think of it as controversial, because we all have this image of the polar bear as, you know, the animal saved the world, the whole, yeah. But up in the Canadian Arctic, yes, they still eat polar bear and they hunt polar bear. But remember, as the Inuit are, they call themselves conservationists because they know about their own habitat. They've been there for thousands of years and they've been using polar bear hide and they've been using polar bear meat to survive on. Today, they limit the number of polar bear that they, what they call, they use the word harvest.
Right.
They talk about it to go harvesting. So in the community of Grease Fjord where I was, to explain, they have a tagging system. They allow themselves and the wildlife system up there allows them to have about 25 to 30 polar bear each year for the community. 25 of those polar bears would be for the community themselves, and then the rest they use to when hunters come up there. I mean, wealthy hunters come from all over the world to go hunting for polar bear, and that money which they get. So if
and how much would
a hunter might it cost him to go out on a 7 or 8 day trip might cost him 15,000 to 18,000 Canadian dollars
right.
to spend 10 days out on the land, out on the ice, and so that money that the hunter gets. One of the hunters I was chatting to before I left, he was about to take actually a well to do Canadian hunter, but the money that he was getting for doing this job goes back into the community. It allows them to survive up there. And that is what is difficult, I suppose, in one sense, to get into your head, that these people are surviving, perched on top of the world,
yeah.
and they're surviving up there. How long more, Grease Fjord, the community that I was in, will it be there in 30 or 40 years' time? My own opinion is that it won't be there in 30 or 40 years' time, that these Inuit will have to move back closer down to what I call the southern part of Canada.
Right. When you talk about the polar bear and indeed the everything else, it's a very controversial thing. Do they then wear the fur?
Yes, they do. Well, sorry. Normally for the polar bear, it's so in the past they used to, but they sell it now, so it's sold on to people. But certainly they use and they wear the seal skin.
Yeah,
I was out with Larry on a number of occasions, and when it was absolutely, when you called the word perishing cold at minus 50,
yeah,
and my hands got, you know, just frozen solid. But Larry would have on the sealskin mitts, and it just, his hands were perfect. So, and they, well, if you're living in that all the time, yeah, constantly living in those temperatures, but that is their tradition. It's like, you know, if you go to the Aran Islands, you know, people used to wear the Bonine sweaters, and the women used to knit the sweaters and the Lena Gurams, all of those things. They have that tradition. And what I found fascinating was one of the ladies in Greasefjord, she was an Inuit. She worked in one of the schools, and she described the joy when a polar bear was harvested. It would be brought back into the community, and five or six of the women would spend, it would take five or six women to actually, you know, to get all the, to get the pelt into a condition in which it could be used. And it has to be done straight away. And then the meat is, well, it's put into the, I don't know what I call the refrigerator up there. They do actually have fridges.
But they
just leave them outside. They put them in boxes. Yeah. And this is...
And did you... I wouldn't have thought you'd need a freezer, actually. So did you eat all this raw stuff as well?
No, I tried seal meat, and I thought it was really difficult. I found it, well, tough in more ways than one. But certainly I tried the muskox and the... But in a way, eating the muskox or the caribou is probably like eating deer or venison down here, the equivalent, and
yeah,
people eat that.
Yeah. But they cook it.
Yeah, I wasn't... Yeah, they cook it here, but up there, it was cooked for me. But the point is, the Inuit, they don't always cook it.
Right.
They, in fact, there was a description for me of when they have a festival, that the they might have a caribou and they might have seal meat, and it's just all laid out on the floor, and they sit down and they eat it, and they eat it raw, and which is, but that is the way of life.
Yeah.
But the key to, if you ask me why did I go there, it's because. And it's an issue which is coming up more and more. I've visited four schools since I've come back. And the one thing that absolutely hits me smack in the face is how young kids in schools are fascinated by what's happening in relation to...
To the ice cap.
Yeah, and the environment.
Yeah.
And that is one of the reasons
and
I wanted...
And what is happening?
It's melting. Marion, there's people who, and the naysayers who say there's no such thing as global warming are talking bunkum. Absolute bunkum. I don't need 10 minutes, by the way, to explain that. it is happening up there. And these Inuit see it. They have been watching it for years. And they see the ice cap melting. They see the glaciers melting around them. And you know what simple example of what they spot when they go out onto the ice. They actually, the JPD, the last time I was there, was able to show me the black smut. You know, it's like if we have fires here or Europe,
yep,
and it's burning up on today. Well, that's what's happening in the Arctic and down in the Antarctic. It's like, you know, what's belching out from the middle of the earth. It's the convection. It's going up to the Arctic regions, and it's going down to the Antarctic regions.
And do ships get into where you are?
Into Greasefjord once a year. That's all. There's only one ship. The people live in many parts of the Arctic. They call it the annual sea lift. Probably once a year, one ship will get in there. And in that, one ship has to bring in all the main goods that the community needs for the whole year.
Like?
Everything from fridges to whatever
they need,
and oil for to heat their homes, because that's how they live now. They heat their homes with oil, and so everything has to be brought in that one ship. And then at this time of the year, it's coming into their summer period. But
yeah,
even in their summer period, Marion, it's still cold, and it may not get much beyond, you know, I'll get +3 or +4.
Right.
But the summer times, and that's what I was told recently, the people up there are now seeing that the ice is melting, and it's melting more rapidly, and that in the summertime where they built their houses, it's the sea level is nudging up and closer to their homes.
Right.
And so the answer is, yeah, the global warming is happening. The glaciers are melting.
And where did you stay? And
I stayed in the house, but they in the, what's happened in the space of 50 years, these people have moved, as I said, from a semi-nomadic state where they lived in sort of huts and with skin over them, and then they were using some canvas, which, you know, if you think back 100 years ago or 150 years ago, the Europeans who were going up there, and it's like the same thing with the Aborigines and the Indians, they used to give these people trinkets. And so there were Europeans have been going up there all the time, so they were getting things. Things have completely changed now, but they have now moved into houses. And in one sense,
the houses as we would recognise them.
Well, yes. But yeah. They're sitting, they're wooden houses, but they're sitting above the permafrost. I mean, there's no, I mean, there's no water, there's no piped water, there's no sewage system that you know.
There's
all
no
has to,
sewage system.
No, it's done by, they now do it by truck. It has to be collected by truck every day from any house that's there and then taken away, which where they've made a sort of a big pond for their sewage. And water has to be delivered every day to the houses. Drinking water has to be delivered every day. So in one sense, there's a little within this tiny community. And this community, by the way, is mirrored many times in the Canadian Arctic among the Inuit. It has to be, so it has to be, there's a daily routine for the people, but yeah, they now live in these houses sitting above the permafrost.
Right. And were you with a family?
Well, I was, strangely enough, I was with the man I stayed with was a man called, a fascinating character called Raymond Mercady. And Raymond was a Cree Indian. Who his partner at one stage was a Flaherty of the famous Robert Flaherty, the Man of Arran movie back in, I think it was the 1920s, one of the most famous movies, early movies. And he also, he went to the Canadian Arctic and he shot this movie called Nanook of the North.
Oh, yes.
So one of his, he had a child by an Inuit and he fecked off back down to America, and the Flaherty family was there. He left a family behind him. And I was actually one of the people in the house was a chap called Peter Flaherty, who and he's now in his 60s. And so I was staying with him. So Raymond, being a Cree Indian, he was looking after Peter because Peter had a disability. And but I found myself, Raymond disappeared for a couple of days. And I found myself looking after Peter Flaherty. I thought it was sort of unique and absolutely bizarre. But yeah, it was. So I stayed with Raymond. But Raymond was he's still a hunter. This is a Saturday, Easter. I would say in a few hours' time, Raymond is taking off out onto the land with his family, with his grandkid who's 5. And they will go off out hunting muskox. There was one other thing that struck me when I was there. The people work within the community, but at any moment they might decide it's time to head off hunting. So when I was there, a lady called Mika and Charlie Noah, she worked as a nurse's assistant in the community, but she decided it was time to go off hunting. So that's what they will do. They'll just head off hunting for a week, off out onto the land. And again, when you think about it, off out onto the ice that's frozen, and they'll go maybe 150 kilometres, 200 kilometres in their skidoos, go hunting, looking for muskox. And it's not just for the fun of it.
Survival.
Because they want it, because it brings back, because the cost of living up there is so great. You know, we sometimes have this image of food security being an issue.
Yeah.
Even in this country today, in Ireland now, you know, because people, the economy and, you know, the cost of living, you know, we think about food security in Africa, you know, it's a huge issue.
Yeah.
But even among the Inuit, it's a huge issue. Because if you live up in Greece Fjord or some of the places way up in beyond the Arctic Circle, the cost of food is 4 times more expensive, at least 4 times more expensive than it is for you and I, or for down what I call in what they call the South.
Because of the distance.
Yeah.
Because and what do they kill them with? Guns?
Like guns, yeah. The store in Greece Fjord sells everything from basically from a needle to an anchor. It's run for the community. It's run, but they have what I call, they have an outsider. They're normally people from Newfoundland, who are given the job. The Inuit don't want to do it themselves, so they have somebody who runs the co-op store up there. So it's a tiny co-op store,
yeah,
but it's for the 130 people who are there. And you go into that store and you will find everything for sale, and there's a whole rail cordoned off of bullets for their guns, which they use. But everything else has to be bought, and that's how they survive. And if you go, you can go in there and you can buy a box of rice with cheese on it or something like that, and it costs you $20.
Wow.
20 Canadian dollars.
Now, the other thing that people are slightly worried about, it is alleged it's very rich in minerals, in oil and in gas.
Well, if you consider that perhaps a quarter of all the oil and gas in the world is still certainly trapped in the Arctic and maybe down in the Antarctic region, but certainly in the Arctic, they talk about maybe is it 15 to 20% of oil and maybe other minerals, coal, everything. Yes, it's all still up there.
Well,
and
we know enough about ourselves now to know that man is going to destroy it up there looking for that oil and gas.
Yeah, and that's one of the fears which the Inuit have. They have rights to their own lands, but basically what they call the federal government, the Canadian government,
yeah,
basically has the rights to most of it. And there's no doubt that once they get the technology and they get the technology right, and it could be, who knows, could be 50 years. But they're trying. You know that in the Russian Arctic, in the,
yeah,
Gazprom, the whole thing with Greenpeace.
Yeah.
And so they're now the Russians. And I know it sounds airy-fairy, but at the North Pole, you know, they've had this, the Russians have planted a flag beneath the North Pole because they're trying to get claim that the North Pole is their territory.
Yeah.
So while it's sort of, you know, maybe so far away, we say, what's going on? But listen, in 30, 40 or 50 years time or 100 years time, they're going to be digging for the oil, mining for the oil and gas and
without
for the diamonds.
Doubt.
And who knows? And that's what Larry said to me. He says, you know, in the past, you know, you saw what happened in the Gulf of Mexico when one of the oil wells burst. Mm. It went.
Oh, yes.
Just imagine it if it's up in the Arctic in the middle of the cold winter.
Anyway,
there's going to be, the world is going to be destroyed if we don't do it in a controlled mechanism.
Well, yeah, but there's just an inevitability, you know, and I know that Greenpeace will come in and I know that we will all mouth about it, but it'll happen, she said, very depressingly for a bank holiday weekend. Anyway, Charlie, congratulations and lovely to see you. It must have been a fantastic experience. And now I have to go to the newsroom and Michael Murphy.
Thank you.